week of October 27th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 466, the podcast that brings you all the dirt that's making news around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, which is slowly becoming Dante's Inferno, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York on 29th Street at Engine 16 Ladder 7, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know, I've never figured out, like, engine company, ladder company. I guess one actually, they actually do represent certain things.
They right? do indeed. And I'm here asking the guys for tips, and they tell me, Sperling, remember this. When there's a fire, get out, stay out, and call 911. Don't try to grab your things. If the door is hot or warm to the touch, don't open the door. If there's smoke, get down low. You're going to need these tips because you are literally risking your life to do the podcast.
That is true because there was a fire just a mile away.
A mile and is really, really close.
And there's another, well, hopefully that one's out. I believe that one's out.
Uh-huh.
There is a much bigger fire that is threatening the Getty Museum.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Which is just like 10 miles away.
But this is not a joke. I mean, you had to do the intro three times. You're a little flustered.
I'm a little flustered, yes.
And I was flustered this week and wanted to give us a pat on the back because I went to Box Office Mojo, where we go every week to look at information, and they had a new redesign. And they've got some stuff behind the paywall now, but fair enough. But the new redesign has daily box office, weekend box office, and weekly box office. So they give you the full week's grosses for every film every week, just like we do. So that's a fascinating little tweak that they have. They've emphasized that more than they were before. Now you can get the full week's gross for every movie out right now. So I feel like people are coming around.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I always wondered why they didn't do that. It's
you're ignoring, in some cases, a majority of the film's grosses that week.
Yeah, and it's very easy to just, just slice and dice the numbers. They're all in a database.
It's money. So, it's money being made.
Now, they only do it for domestic, by the way.
Right, right. We don't have international grosses that go for the full week. Though we do because we take the full final total on Sunday and subtract the full total gross 1 week earlier. And doing that's how we get the worldwide grosses.
That's
so
right.
We do get the full week grosses. It's kind of simple to do. They could do it too. It's just math. You know,
good luck with that.
Yeah, math is easy. So you're under fire, literally. We've got people stampeding to join our weekly gross perspective on the box office and our worldwide gross, but we still got a show to do amidst all this chaos. We've got a show to do. You've been away for a week. Hope you had a good trip. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we head to the Middle Kingdom for a lengthy stay. I've been gone for 2 weeks, and during that time, apparently half the companies in America found themselves wrestling without a new business with an oppressive Chinese government without compromising their values. Just kidding. They don't want to compromise their bottom line, and that means placating both the brutal Chinese leaders and consumers in the West. It ain't easy. In sexual misconduct news, we were going to mention how many more women have come forward to say Cuba Gooding Jr. manhandled them in public against their will, and that Rachel Maddow publicly shamed NBC executives who are trying but failing to defend their years of covering up abuse by male stars, or at least their male stars, and executives like Matt Lauer, although I guess he's more of a newscaster. But I convinced Michael this would do the job nicely, and we could move on. So you're welcome. That's our coverage.
Oh, well.
On Inside Baseball, we take a brisk look at the new TV season. Ratings are down almost any way you slice them. And the clear message is this. People's viewing habits have changed probably forever, and it's not going to help TV channels trying to sell eyeballs to advertisers. Maybe they can sell fingers. Who knows? In other words, start watching The Good Place right now. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. And if you come to our show notes, you'll find 2 weeks worth of box office. We have the worldwide box office for the week of October 20th. That's where Joker was number one and Maleficent was number two. And this week, we've got a new chart. It's for the week of October 27th. We're looking at the total box office for the entire last 7 days. And the number one movie around the world is Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. It made $140 million worldwide. It's at $293 million and counting. at North America, it and Joker are in a minute-by-minute battle that's going to come down to the pennies as to who's number one in North America for the weekend's box office. But overall, worldwide, Maleficent is on top with just about $300 million worldwide. Right behind it is Joker, another $112 million worldwide. It's at $850 million and counting. People were saying last week when we were away, this movie looks like it could hit $900 million. No. This is a billion-dollar movie. Unless something bizarre happens, it will gross $1 billion, which is unbelievable. If it had made $300 million, they would have all said, wow, good job. And at number three around the world is the reason we look at the worldwide box office and not just North American movies or even how they're doing around the world. It's the Chinese drama Better Days. It opened at the last minute and made $85 million on its opening week. Now, this is a movie that was banned in China. They stopped it right at the last minute before it came out months ago. It's about a student getting ready for their college entrance exams, and there's bullying involved and some other stuff like that. It's an interesting movie, and just at the last minute, like literally 2 or 3 days before it was coming out, the Chinese government said, okay, you can release it. So they had no time to prepare for this movie, but apparently getting banned and yanked from screenings right before it opens up helps the movie because it opened to $85 million. I'm sure it didn't cost anywhere near that. It's just a drama with teens. So this movie made people were waiting to see this movie. And if there were counterfeit copies, that did not stop them going to the box office. So a big, big win for that movie.
Well, I mean, look, it's the same in the US and in Europe. You know, you ban a movie and people want to go see it half the time.
Yeah, but normally, I mean, they only have 2 or 3 days to prepare for a release. That's what surprises me a little bit. The fact that they just dropped it in theaters and everybody went right away. Everybody knew. That's, I guess, the power of the internet, right? Oh, the movie's opening. Let's go quick before they shut it down again.
Right.
At number four around the world is Zombieland 2 Double Tap. That made another $31 million. It opened up last week, I guess. Yes, it did. And made just about the same money last week. It's at $63 million worldwide. At number five is Gemini Man, the Ang Lee film. Another $30 million. It's at about $150 million, which is just about the movie's box office. This is not going to end up well. It's in how many territories is it in? Gemini Man is playing in 61 territories. So there are some big territories to go, I imagine, but this is not going to be a good story.
Well, in more ways than one.
Yeah. And number six is the dirt cheap animated film, The Addams Family. $28 million it made last week. It's at $84 million worldwide. Right below that is Abominable, another relatively inexpensive animated film. They were hoping for a bigger push from China. That didn't pan out, but it is at $144 million worldwide. And number eight is The Captain. This is that Chinese drama about a pilot who helps land a plane during an emergency. That made another $16 million. It's just about to hit $400 million worldwide. That's almost to the dollar the same amount of money of My People, My Country, that anthology drama that was also opened up in China on Country Day, National Day, on October 1st. So those two movies are neck and neck. We thought The Captain would pass it by easily, and it probably will, but not by a lot. Going back to the charts at number nine is Terminator Dark Fate. It opened up in a few territories, not just one or two, and it made $12 million. And that's pretty disappointing because it was in some bigger territories. It is not doing well. So people are not excited by this movie overseas. We'll have to see what happens when it opens up here in North America. But for its start, not good. And number 10 is Countdown. This opened up, I think, basically North America. This is a low-budget horror flick. It made $10 million. It only cost $7 million to make. And it's about an app that all the cool young kids are downloading called Countdown. Hey, get that app downloaded. It tells you how long you're going to live. And you download the app, and then it says, 67 years, 14 days, and 5 hours. And you laugh. Or it says, 3 years and 5 hours. And that's not so funny. Or it says 17 hours. This is one of those ideas that makes you think, damn, I wish I thought of that. That is commercial. I don't mean it's a good movie, but you can sell that. And
well, speaking of selling things, I interviewed the person at the MENA Cinema Forum and I can't remember the name of the film, but it's Perfect Strangers, I think, is the name of Relative Strangers, I think, is the name of the Italian film where everybody puts their cell phones on the table.
Oh, right. We were talking about that.
And it's been remade like 18 times.
Yes.
And this person's remaking it for the Middle East.
Oh, hilarious. And it says trapped. We don't have an American version because it got caught up in the Weinstein people, I believe.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right.
That's right. So was it a good convention? Was it productive and successful for you?
Very good. Yes, it was incredibly, incredibly productive, and it grew a lot over last year's.
Were you mobbed everywhere you went from people going, Showbiz Sandbox, Showbiz Sandbox?
Actually, believe it or not, twice.
People oh, really?
Came up to me. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, much like in Expo Cine in Brazil.
Very fun, very fun. All right, well, back to the charts. At number 12 is Black and Blue. This is a new drama about a new cop, left the military, joined the police force, and now she's looking at corruption. It grossed $8 million on its opening week. That stars, is it Naomi Harris? Is that how you say her name? Yes.
Yes.
I believe so. All right, at number 13, Downton Abbey, still chugging along. That's at $175 million worldwide. At number 14, here's a Chinese film ready to be remade. Guilt by Design, it's called. It's about a juror on a trial who has his child kidnapped, and they tell him, you need to throw the trial or we will, you know, kill your child. So, you know, seems like a no-brainer to me. $7 million on its opening week, which is the same amount of Houseful 4. This is the fourth in a series of Indian reincarnation comedies. They're all different plots, but they're sort of the same vague style. There's some cast members that fall over from one to the next, but it's kind of a new movie every time, but the same idea. It made $7 million on its opening week, so people still love Houseful 4. Hustlers is moving along, $136 million worldwide. A Shaun the Sheep movie called Farmageddon. Shaun the Sheep.
Farmageddon, that's
clever. That's clever. It made $7 million. This week, it's at $16 million worldwide because it opened last week while we were away. One Piece Stampede is that Japanese animated film that opened up in China. It fell hard in its second week, but it still made $6 million, and its total is $84 million worldwide. And I skipped one film, and it is a Korean film. It's at number 17. It made $7 million. It's called Kim Ji-young and Born 1982. Kim Ji-young, Born 1982. It's based on a feminist novel, I guess we'll call it that, about a woman, and it follows her whole life from birth up to the present and shows the massive prejudice and discrimination that women face at every stage of their lives, beginning with her birth, where her mother gives birth to her and then turns to the mother-in-law and apologizes for having a girl. You know, you're supposed to provide a boy, and the first child they had is a girl, and she immediately apologizes for having her child, a healthy baby girl, and she apologizes. And it just goes on from there. This novel was a sensation. It was the first million-selling novel in Korea in almost a decade, apparently. Hugely controversial. And I'm putting that in quotes because it talks about prejudice against women. And literally, all the women who were cast in the film had to defend themselves. If you just said, I'm reading this book, and you were a celebrity, people would storm you with abuse. Oh, you're that anti-man book. I mean, this is a very hot topic of a book and a movie, and it's opened up decently, and we'll have to see how it goes. But it's a fascinating cultural insight into Korea. Now, you know, Joker, we talked about, that is going to be a huge film. It's the highest grossing rated R film of all time.
Yeah, you know that actually happened while I was away, and that they announced it. You know, Comscore was there in Dubai, and that's exactly what they said.
Yes, and you know they've done it without China.
Yes,
the second biggest market.
It's not opening in China.
Oh no, they're not. It's too violent. They're not going to do it. It's the second high. You know, it's the second biggest market in the world, and this movie is making $1 billion without them. Hey, Chinese films do it sometimes themselves. They make most of their money in China. American movies sometimes do without China, but still, that shows how impressive the box office for this movie was. It'd be fascinating to know or wonder what it would do if it did open up in China, how they would react to it. But it's a $1 billion movie. But we did have some smaller films in release in North America. Roadside Attractions had some good news. The Judy Garland biopic Judy and their other film, The Peanut Butter Falcon, both crossed the $20 million mark. So that's great news for those two indie films. And then we had the opening of Bruce Springsteen's Western Stars, that documentary slash concert film. That opened up and made about $500,000 over the weekend. Its total, because it had some previews last week, is $1 million, which isn't bad. But I thought it cost like a lot. I remember Warner Brothers paying a lot to pick it up, and I couldn't find the number. Because weren't we debating? And I said, well, that's way too much money. And you're like, hey, he's a star. Warner Brothers thinks he's a star. And I'm like, he's not going to bring that many people to the movie theater.
Well, and I wonder, is he on Warner Music?
No.
Just a thought. I think they previewed it the week before, and I think that's when most Bruce Springsteen
fans
would have
gone. It made about $500,000 last week, and it made about $500,000 over the weekend. So its total is $1 million.
Okay.
Yeah, so it did not make $8 million last week and $500,000 this week. So yeah, they showed it last week one night, and then they showed it again all weekend long. So that's where it's at. And in fact, over the weekend, he was beaten by Kanye West. Springsteen had a full, 100-minute film, a concert film, bonus features and extras, him chatting away about his career and his philosophy of life. Kanye West had an experimental 32-minute short film called Jesus is King, and that grossed $800,000 in North America and $1 million worldwide. I think all of it on IMAX screens. So that little experiment sure paid off in terms of, we don't know the budget, but it seems like it was a lot less than what Springsteen was paid for. And then you look at The Lighthouse, that's in the top 10 in North America. Jojo Rabbit is in the top 15. And Kanye West is going to hit number one on the Billboard charts with his new album. So a lot of fun activity in the top 20 in North America. Some good experimental films, things working on IMAX, art films are clicking. It's good to see a nice strong mix in the North American charts.
Well, and that's one of the things that I noticed in going to all of these conferences. Yes, Hollywood kind of rules the roost, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. definitely have, Hollywood titles bringing in a large percentage of the box office. But at the same time, there is a thirst and a desire for local content.
And that's the best thing Hollywood could hope for. You want local content because you want a healthy box office, and it's not healthy if they don't have that mix. You also want new stars and new directors to be built. It's just good for everybody when you have a healthy local box office. Competition is good for everyone. You can make crappy films and make some money. You're going to get lazy and start making worse and worse films and hurt yourself ultimately. So when you've got a strong French box office and a strong Turkish cinema and strong Russian films and Chinese and Japanese, that's good for everybody. So they shouldn't see that as like, oh no, they're taking away our business. It's like, no, they're creating new fans for movies, people who are going to go to the movies more often when they get to see themselves on screen. And then you end up with great directors like Ang Lee and Zhang Yimou and so on and so forth. But what I don't understand is why you'd want to remake a really bad movie.
I mean, there's so many movies that get remade.
Well, they're doing a remake of Curtis Hanson's 1987 film, The Bedroom Window. I assume you haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, that was going to be what I asked about. What movie is this?
Blumhouse is doing it. It's a co-production directed by Ben Young. And my response is, why? 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 It stars Steve Guttenberg and Isabelle Huppert and Elizabeth McGovern. It is an early film, or his first film, for Curtis Hanson. And it's one of the movies that taught me to never dismiss a director, because this movie is so inept that you would never think that the guy who made it could make a good movie, much less a great film like L.A. Confidential. But he did. So, I'm not a particularly dismissive, like, this actor's got no talent. It's like, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what they've got. And someday it might be the right person, the right role. This movie's so awful. I mean, Steve Guttenberg, it's just he's lovers with Isabelle Huppert and Elizabeth McGovern. Already you're thinking, really?
Yeah, lost me at Steve Guttenberg.
It wasn't a hit. It made $12 million, at the time at the worldwide box office. It cost maybe $25 million if you adjust for inflation. But we don't quite know the budget, but it certainly wasn't a hit film. Certainly wasn't a movie anybody liked. It got dreadful reviews. And all I can remember from the film, he's testifying on the stand in a trial, and he wasn't the witness, but he's pretending to be the eyewitness. And Isabelle Huppert was the witness, but she's afraid to speak up. So she's in the room, in the trial, sitting there, and he's trying to answer questions. And she's saying, like, he was 5'7" and 100. She's trying to give him answers, and she's yelling it out, whispering, stage whispering, to the point where everybody, including the killer, is turning around going, who's telling him what to say on the stand? I mean, it was just so stupid. And the idea that they're remaking it blows my mind. I can't even imagine. That is just, they'll remake anything. If they're remaking The Bedroom Window, a crappy drama that nobody whatsoever has any fond memories of, I just don't know.
Why can't they just make kind of swipe it and nobody would be any the wiser.
Right. And if China's smart, they will not allow that film into their country.
Why is that?
I'm just segueing into China versus the world.
Well, okay. I mean, I think we started talking about this. I think it was before on the last show. Episode.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely.
Where, I think it was both South Park and the NBA were having trouble with China. I guess China said, you know what, South Park, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to show your television show anymore. How about that?
Well, here's the thing that we improperly caught there. They were never showing the show. It's not available in China. It never was. They don't allow South Park in China. So when they talked about scrubbing any reference to South Park, they really meant any references, because it wasn't a show that Chinese people could stream anyway. So it's not like they yanked it from the air or said, oh, you're enjoying those episodes, we're going to pull them out because now we've decided it's... No, no, no. They don't allow that show in their country. It mocks authority. It mocks, you know, all sorts of things that they don't want people thinking or talking about. So it's never been available in that country. So we should have more properly said, you know what? They already hate the show. So what if who cares if they scrub references to the show? They don't, as far as people in China are concerned, the show barely exists.
I guess what would really be a problem is if they say, who makes that? Oh, Viacom, and Viacom owns Paramount and CBS. Okay, right. well, let's just not invite any of them.
And yet they have a real problem. Big Paramount shows and movies scheduled to be released in the movie theaters in China. So they are not linking them because they also don't want to look weak. You know, we talked about how it's a big problem for these companies and how to deal with it, but it is also a problem for China because they want a good, positive image around the world, and this is not helping them. And a couple things are going on. A lot of things happened. The problem is metastasized. You know, it went from one or two companies to like 10 companies are suddenly facing questions about how they work with China, self-censorship and the like.
What you just said right there is really the key, yeah. Right? I mean, that's what we're really talking about here is there are no rules in China regarding censorship, or there's no ratings board. And that was one of the things that when the Saudi Arabia, when that government decided to let cinemas open again, the first thing that every trade group, whether it was the MPAA or NATO or UNIC or the UK Cinema Association, everybody said, listen, you need to get a ratings board so that we know what is allowed and what isn't allowed.
Somewhere Jack Valenti is smiling.
Well, because the problem is there are no rules, and it's purposeful. They do that on purpose.
Well, they can yank anything anyway. Even if they make rules, they can always change their mind. It's not a government where you can appeal or go to the courts and say, I'm not happy with this decision. But yes, it helps companies make their decisions more transparently, even though they have to understand they have to kowtow to the government anyway. So the NBA's had trouble, and it looked like Tencent had started restreaming some NBA games, but that's not what happened. There was a brief suspension, and then they started streaming NBA games again, but not quite. Most of the games were not live streamed. Sometimes they just displayed the score. Even live streams no longer allow English translation or audio, so you're not following what's happening or what the commentators are saying. And they also instituted a several minute delay, which won't matter unless you're looking at the scores online or something, but they wanted to avoid showing protesters. Because live games on TV are on hold completely. And if you were watching in America, you saw people protesting for Hong Kong, people protesting for Taiwan, wearing t-shirts, spelling out messages. And China's like, you're not showing that on our TVs. So they put in a multi-minute delay so they could make sure all that stuff was cut out.
Yeah, you know, you saw Richard Gere. He was there. Yeah. You know, free Tibet. I'm kidding, of course, but that is one of those moments in life that, got the Academy Awards into big trouble.
And then what happened in Vietnam? I mean, you just see this happening. Like, there are oppressive governments all over the world, governments fighting over territory and things, and the problems that Hollywood faces are endless.
Are you talking about the Abominable issue?
Yes,
right?
Tell us.
So I guess Abominable, and it's kind of interesting that why bother including this at all, right? I mean, that would be my question.
But that's self-censorship then.
Right, but I guess...
If you needed a map, what map do you show?
Well...
Sometimes you're showing a map.
Yeah, I guess I didn't. I haven't seen the film, so I can't just see it. So in Abominable, there's a map of China that includes the South China Sea, which is, China says is theirs, and every other country in the world says, no, it's not.
And so Vietnam yanked the movie from distribution in the theaters.
That's right. Yes, and so I guess my question is, why not just show a a map of China, like mainland China, and call it a day.
That's not acceptable to them because they want you to show their map, which is the map showing China is not just mainland China. They say insist it includes those other areas. That's the problem. If you show a map that's internationally recognized, China says that map is wrong. You're not showing us as owning all this territory in Taiwan and Hong Kong. You have to label it the way we want it, or we're going to get angry at you. So there is no neutral map.
Can you also say, hey, it's an animated movie. Some people call them cartoons. It's not real life.
Well, that doesn't help because they know the power of culture. And ESPN got in trouble for the same thing. They used a map on air for some reason with a similar image on it. Essentially, it's a U-shaped line called the Nine Dash Line. And it indicates a huge swatch of area in the South China Sea that's rich in resources, which China is claiming for itself. And they're installing military bases on isolated islands to try to strengthen
the building islands. They're literally...
They're doing that too, yes. They're building islands. They're putting bases there. They're claiming some... they're just going all... And if you don't use a map with that image, China will get angry with you. So, it gets very difficult. It's also known as the 11-dash line. Then it was a bridge to the typical 9-dash line, and now it's been expanded to a 10-dash line. So if you're trying to kowtow to China, you're like, which map do I use? The 10-dash line? The 9-dash line? They've been making this claim since 1947, but they have never pursued it in international court. The Philippines challenged it and won an arbitration in 2013. Both China and Taiwan dispute that, which it's nice to know they can agree on something. So it's just a nightmare for people. If you're showing a map of the world, you better make sure China doesn't get angry at you. Well, just don't show a map. But suddenly you're not showing maps anymore because you're afraid of pissing off China. It's not easy.
Well, I mean, look, you do certain things in certain countries because, for cultural relevancy.
You don't want to name your car smelly car or realize the name in English means piece of junk in, whatever country you're selling it in, Vietnam or Korea or something. But there's a difference between being culturally sensitive and, giving up your values or giving up your respect for freedom and democracy or international law because you want to make a quick buck. And if you do that to appease the government, you might start pissing off your customers. And that's the problem that American companies are facing. The NBA is like, we don't want to be not supportive of freedom and democracy, but we want to keep making lots of money in China. So they just feel beleaguered. They wish everybody would just shut up.
That is very true.
And while you were gone, we had the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood fracas, I believe.
Are they not showing? Is China not showing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I thought they were.
No, they blocked it, apparently over pleas from the Bruce Lee family, who said this movie insults one of the most famous Chinese people of all time. Don't show this movie. For a minute there, it looked like they were going to re-edit the film to sort of soften it. And Tarantino said, no, I'm not. And, I don't like that scene, but good for him. He's like, I'm not re-editing it to appease the Chinese government. He's standing by the film as it is. And I said, good for you. Even though I didn't even like that particular scene. But you know what? China's never been a big territory for him. I mean, they yanked Django Unchained the day it opened because it got approved, got put in theaters, and then some party official saw it and said, this is too violent. So they yanked it away from the theaters again. So they probably weren't counting on a lot of money from China, and they don't need it.
Yeah, at this point, not at all.
Yeah. So, like you said, will they start blaming the companies and trying to put pressure on them? Like, they don't like South Park, so maybe they're not going to open Gemini Man. Well, they did. Maybe they won't open Mission Impossible. Well, it's due up. And you know what? If you block them, you may be hobbling your local box office. And guess what? China wants the local box office to keep growing. So remove Mission Impossible from the end of the year list, and maybe your box office is going to fall for the first time in a decade. So it ain't easy for the Chinese government either, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, yes, that is true. It does look like China will actually increase this year.
Yeah. But if they yanked three or four American films, then they wouldn't.
Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what everybody is concerned about box office wise is not this year. Everyone is concerned about next year.
Why is that?
There's just, when you look at the slate, there's no big giant movies. However, everybody believes, not everybody, some believe that there's always one, two, sometimes three films that come out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And they make like, oh my God, the Joker, we didn't expect that. We thought 300 million, we'd be really happy. And 900 million? Who knew? There's always films like, Downton Abbey. We thought, 60 million. Oh my gosh, it's over 100 million. We're really happy. But There's no Star Wars. There's no Avengers. So you have, you know, it's definitely going to be a down year or what, or a flat year, which if it's flat, everybody will be ecstatic.
I would assume it'd be harder for outsiders to look at the Chinese lineup and know which films are really promising.
Oh, I'm talking about just globally. Okay. I'm not talking about just China.
Globally. I was talking about the Chinese market. Well, going back to China, the final problem, the best thing that the Chinese government has for it, going for it, is not its ability to punish companies or to force people to do what they want. It's that companies eager to make money there will do China's job for it. That's what happened when an esports company started muzzling an independent player. China didn't have to say a thing. And then there was a story in Deadline. We like Deadline a lot. We have Jeff Boucher on the show. But they had a story talking about South Park. And they said that South Park mocked China's, quote, strict customs. No, they weren't talking about strict customs. They were talking about, you know, human rights abuses and crimes against humanity involving Muslims, Hong Kong, prison populations used for organ harvesting, you know, that sort of thing. And that sort of self-editing does China's job for them. So it's not easy for China. It's not easy for other companies. And it ain't easy for the media trying to cover them.
Yeah, you know, what's going to be interesting about this, in my opinion, is before companies could do this, and nobody really took notice of it, but now everybody has their eye on it.
On everything, yeah. Absolutely. So, boycott, boycott. You know, so, you know, it's not a big deal when someone does a hashtag of boycott, you know, Fortnite. Some person mounts that and people go, oh, look at that. It's a boycott. It's like somebody just put a hashtag on a tweet, you know, calm down. When a million people sign up to it and start acting on it, then you can talk.
Well, yes, if people boycotted Fortnite, it would be a big deal. But I wonder what you think of some of the stories in our Big Deal or Big Whoop segment this week, whether they're a big deal or not. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the streaming rights for South Park are up for grabs. Here we are talking about South Park again. The show began streaming on Netflix and then jumped to Hulu. That contract is up, and about six outlets are vying for exclusive U.S. streaming rights, though you can bet Disney and Apple TV aren't among them. The long-running hit sitcom is a magnet for younger viewers and could snag $500 million for a multi-year pact. Now, who wants to piss off China? Anyone? Anyone? Big deal or big whoop?
And Bueller? Bueller? Yeah. This is not a big deal or big whoop. It's available via streaming, and it will be again soon, and somebody will make a pile of cash over it. However, it was funny to point out Disney Plus and Apple are not in this game. You know, Disney Plus is the family-friendly label, and Apple apparently wants to do the same thing. And you kind of think, you know what? We've already got one of those. Are you sure you want to be in that lane? You know, you don't want to have anything edgy or anything that's not family friendly. And I've the early reviews for their first four shows across the board poor. You know,
really?
All of them have gotten.
So this is Apple you're talking about.
Yes, for Apple. Yeah, no, the Disney stuff's not available yet. But terrible reviews for the morning show and mixed to poor reviews for C and the other stuff. The only one that got a decent review anywhere was for All Mankind, and that was not a rave. So, you know, it's hard creating content. What Netflix did, you know, we've been sort of defending Netflix. It's not like we have stock in Netflix, but it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to pivot from DVDs to streaming. That isn't easy. That's a big technological challenge. But then to say we're going to create our own content and do it well, that's a whole different world that you're in now. Apple's never done anything like this, and it's not easy to suddenly snap your fingers and create good TV shows. And they're showing you, even with big tech, you know, big paychecks, not easy thing to do.
Yeah, you know, so. I didn't know. When did all of these
today.
Reviews?
They're just today.
Oh, because they're launching soon, aren't they? I should know exactly when they're launching.
I keep forgetting whether we should call it Apple Plus or Apple TV, because Apple TV is the device to stream, right? Like Roku. So I forget what their streaming service is called.
Here's my fear, really, that I'm going to subscribe to this thing at $5 a month, right? And then they'll come out with a better, bigger version of it.
What do you mean?
That Apple, you know,
well,
as
it's a
Apple
monthly
does,
thing. You don't have to commit, so you could switch to a better, bigger version if you like it better.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you know, here I bought AirPods. Now they have AirPods Pro.
Well, it's not announced yet, is it?
AirPods Pro?
Yeah.
Just this morning.
When?
Earlier this morning.
No, it was supposed to be tomorrow. I need to go to the store. Goodbye. I cannot afford them. How much are they?
$250.
Son of a bitch. It's $10 less than they said. Son of a bitch. It's probably already sold out. Are they in stores or when do they get in stores?
They go into stores on October 30th. I don't know how this became an Apple commercial.
Yeah, really. Well, I'm really unhappy with my current AirPods, but I do like them for phone calls a lot. And they're not good enough for music. And it's been driving me nuts. And I didn't want to buy them until the new version was out. So there you go. So yeah, Apple, they make good stuff sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
With people throwing themselves off the roofs of buildings in China.
Oh, man. Right back to China.
Yeah, bring it back to China. So, yeah, you know, South Park, not a big deal. Apple TV, I'm not sure if they want to have the family-friendly aura. Is that necessary? It's okay to make some edgy stuff. But, you know, there's still six people vying for South Park. This is a big property.
It's chaos at the talent agency Endeavor. Okay, not chaos, but they are not happy campers. For years, the company positioned itself to go public, and everybody knew it. It invested in all sorts of disparate companies, took on a ton of debt, handed out stock options rather than cash bonuses, all with an eye on an IPO so everyone could cash out and the company could face the future stronger than ever and be less dependent on the quarterly earnings of talent that had an annoying habit of, you know, ups and downs in their careers. Then came failed IPOs from other new companies like WeWork and a major exodus of writers over Endeavor's plans to go public, among other issues. So Endeavor postponed their IPO. Then they yanked the plans entirely, licking their wounds and saying the company would not go public anytime soon, though it left the door open for doing so in the future. Now all the employees who took options rather than cash, they're wondering what happens next and when do they get their payday? Big deal or big whoop? Meanwhile, all they have to do is go to the nearest convenience store, payday candy bars. They're like $2.
Do you think it's a big deal? I think it is. I mean,
it is a big deal. Yes. Yeah. For them to, because, you know, they weren't the only company that was doing this kind of thing. You know, that was taking on private equity, taking on debt. Private equity, one way to get out is you sell. Another way is you go public. So CAA, which has, you know, equity owners, what were they going to do?
This has been their master plan. It wasn't like, oh, this is one thing we'll do. This is everything has been working towards the IPO. That's how everything is supposed to pay off and work. You know, that's why they bought all these companies and all that. And so blowing up in their face, again, one can't help thinking about the WGA, you know, but there was a bad market in general. But again, you've got this looming thing over your head, and the WGA made their case for sharing contract info, and I thought they made some good points. They said a couple things. They said, you know what? Knowledge is power. Agents have the info about what they're paying you. Studios have the info. The only people who don't know are the writers themselves. They don't know what's being paid for services. And you know, they want to fight against free work and late pay, and they can't do that if they don't know what you're getting paid and what the contracts are. And they say that data from across the industry will allow writers to know the answers to these questions on their own. Things like, what's the median salary for the job I'm about to take? That could be industry-wide or even as specific as, quote, a first-time co-producer on an ABC hour-long show. In features, does Studio A typically only do one-step deals? What about their competitors? If Studios B and C typically offer better terms, would I rather try to work for those places? What's my studio's pay range for pilots? What about their competitors? And they say, look at sports. In all the major sports leagues, this is a quote, agents have long been required to submit all player contracts to their respective unions. So the NBPA, for example, receives all of LeBron James's contracts. And just like the NBPA and other sports unions, the WGA has strict protocols in place to ensure that every member's individual privacy is protected. So they're saying it's done in other businesses. It works for other people. You don't know the answers to a lot of these questions, but the studios do. So you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back. They're trying to tell their own members, look, this is why we need to know the contracts.
Yeah, you know, there are lots of antitrust issues why this could be a little tricky. I'm sure that they could get around it by keeping certain things confidential,
anonymized.
Under lock. Yes,
yeah.
Anonymized. Because the reality is, you know, if you have the WGA accepting contracts and kind of telling members, well, you have to ask for X, Y, and Z because,
well,
you know,
that's not how it works. They're not going to give you specific advice. They're just going to have general industry knowledge. The whole point is not to say, well, Bob got this. They're going to say, and here's what you should ask for. They're going to say, this is what ABC or these companies are typically offering. You know, this is if you're getting 40,000 and normally paying 80,000, you want to know that. But it's not about saying what Susie Q got. I mean, it's being done in other businesses.
Is it? The
NBA.
Yeah, collective bargaining, you mean?
No. All their contracts are known. The NBA knows the contracts for every player in the NBA. And all the major sports leagues.
Yeah.
Their unions have all that info. So baseball, football, basketball.
I don't know that I'd use a monopoly to describe how antitrust works. Well, given
the
that,
players
union
is not the monopoly in that case.
No. MLB is a monopoly.
Right. Information is not a monopoly. Having information on contracts does not turn you into a monopoly. It means you have information on contracts.
No, it's the collusion issue. That's
there's no collusion if a players union gets contract information. That's not collusion.
Well, and by the way, this is a very controversial subject when it comes
only
to
only if you're
like,
an agent.
Well, no, what I mean is like most favored nations. So take it out of the entertainment industry for a second. Most favored nations, it's basically backwards.
We're not talking about
backwards
that.
Price fixing.
They're not talking about the most favored nation clauses. They're not saying.
Right.
They're saying we want the information so we can tell our members this is typically what people get in the industry for an entry level, person in a writing room on a sitcom on a major network or on a streamer. If you're not getting that, you should be a little surprised because that's kind of standard.
Yeah, I think that, that's their beef with the agencies, but I wonder if the networks and studios would want to be giving the WGA that information.
Well, they don't have any choice. The agencies will have to, somebody has the contract. You just got to share with the writers union. The studios can't keep the contract secret from the people they're hiring. The writers.
True.
Yeah. So there you go.
Well, now the Booker Prize looked at the Nobel Prize and said, hey, if you guys think you can give out two awards, why can't we really? That's what we want to know. Of course, the Nobel awarded one prize for 2018 and another for 2019. So it was really filling in a gap, not naming two winners in the same year. Awards don't like ties, okay? They want one clear winner. Just ask La La Land, But the Booker has done it before. In 1992, the most prestigious award in the world for a single work of fiction was given to two novels, The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, or I always mess up that name, Ondaatje, and Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth. That's when the rules were changed so a tie would never happen again. Every once in a while, a jury gets hung up and says, are you sure we can't give it to two books? And the response by the Booker committee is, no, you can't. Nope. You must choose. This year, the jury said, are you absolutely sure we can't give the Booker to two novels? And they were told no once again. Then they asked once more and were told once more, no, you must choose one novel or the other. And then finally, the jury said, out of hell with the patriarchy, and announced two women would split the Booker Award. Margaret Atwood won for The Testaments, her sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, and Bernardine Evaristo won for Girl, Woman, Other. So there, Big Giller, big whoop.
I guess it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Two people were honored instead of one, but of course, when they make them share, it has to be women, right? Like the men aren't going to share, but when we'll let the two women share. And of course, a woman of color gets denied full victory. Bernardine Evaristo would have been the first woman of color to win the Booker Prize, but now she's not because she only co-won it. Though she is, but she isn't, because there's still an asterisk by that win. You know what? One year, in 2012, the Pulitzer named no winners, despite three books on their shortlist. So that happens. So, these things go on.
So they were all losers. Can you say, I lost the Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah.
Well, Pulitzer Prize loser?
I was very empathetic to people who said, just got to pick a winner. And there was a publisher of one of the other books that was shortlisted. And he made some very good points about the jury's comments indicating they weren't doing their job. They said things like, well, how can you overlook the massive, wonderful body of work of Margaret Atwood? And he's like, that's not your job. You're only supposed to be talking about this one book, not about her career. It's not a career award. Or they said, Bernardine Evaristo has been overlooked. It's like, no, you're not supposed to, counterbalance media coverage. You're supposed to just say which one of these books is the best. And he felt like they didn't do their job. And I empathize with that. But on the other hand, you say, well, how could you not choose between them? Or it's so dismissive of the other books when you say, well, these two, we can't decide, but the rest, we know they're not the number one. So he felt that was dismissive, but it's not. You make a list of the best films of the year. Sometime you have one movie that's a clear choice Sometimes there's no clear choice. And some years you have two or three films that are masterpieces and all the rest are like below them. So
and then some years you have movies that are on Netflix and you select the Green Book.
Right. And the Nobel Prize, you know, we talked about Peter Handke and that award. The Times Literary Supplement has a good piece on his body of work, which we were wondering about, mostly plays and his collaborations with Wim Wenders. We have a link to that. We also have a link to The Intercept. They have a damning article that documents his relentless years-long work of genocidal denialism. I mean, they really make a scathing commentary on Peter Handke. The basic thrust, I think, would be ultimately, you know what, you're just trying to honor somebody. Even if their body work is good, why do you have to honor somebody who's, you know, that vile in their public life and their public behavior? You know,
yeah, you someone couldn't else. Find somebody else?
Yeah. And this is the worst. John Banville, excellent writer, wonderful literary writer, also writes mysteries under a pseudonym. He received a hoax phone call telling him he'd won the Nobel Prize. And for 40 minutes, he thought he had won the Nobel Prize. That is just, oh my God. And it was the phone number looked like it came from Sweden. They believe it came from inside Sweden. They're investigating it. Somebody looks like somebody trying to make the committee look stupid or ridiculous. They're like, no, we didn't call him. We didn't change our minds. Nothing like that. It's awful and terrible. I mean, oh God, what an awful thing to do. That is just cruel, cruel, cruel.
Well, imagine having to push through more than 100 books to name the best one of the year.
I couldn't do it.
It's pretty overwhelming for people sitting on juries like the Booker. They should thank the gods that self-published titles can't be submitted. According to reports, the number of self-published titles in North America alone grew by 40% in 2018 compared to 1 year earlier. They went from 1.1 million to 1.6 million. But wait, there's more. That number doesn't include most of the books published via Amazon because most of those books don't even bother to get an ISBN number, which is how the other number was tracked down. So on the Amazon Kindle platform, about 1.4 million titles were self-published in 2018. That's worldwide, we think, not just North America. So of course, a lot more titles could be added to this pile. But the fact is that in 2018, it's safe to say at least 3 million titles were self-published worldwide. Big deal or big whoop.
I mean, 3 million titles.
But here's the thing. A lot of the titles will be published, you know, let's say at Barnes & Noble. So you need an ISBN number. And you also want to publish on Amazon. So they kind of force you to get an Amazon number. Or they give it to you when you show up there.
No, there's not redundancy. The numbers that we have don't even include every other country in the world, you know, that's self-publishing. So you're self-publishing in England, France, Germany, Spain, Japan, Australia, and people are. Those numbers aren't included in the number of books getting ISBN numbers in North America. So it's easily 3 million books worldwide every year being self-published. And what I can't understand is how it grew 40% in 1 year. I couldn't figure out any reason whatsoever why
North
American...
Everybody with a pen thinks they're an author.
Well, I don't know. There should be some more better explanation of that. And if somebody knows, contact us. Let us know.
Yes, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
That's
right. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. And we're also on Facebook, where you can like our page, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody with a pen thinks they're a writer, and everyone with a mic thinks they're a podcaster.
That's true. Wait a second.
I'm slapping us.
Now, Dinah Washington sang the song, What a Difference a Day Makes.
What a difference a day makes.
But speed it up, Dinah.
What a difference a quarter makes. Oh.
Yeah, one quarter ago, Netflix announced it signed up fewer new subscribers than expected.
Kill them! Burn them at the stake!
They practically did. Netflix had raised prices in the U.S., and the quarter didn't feature a big anticipated debut like Stranger Things. Well, everything will get better, they said. Their stock fell 20%, with investors worried about all that new competition from Disney and Universal and Apple, and then, Michael, you and I are launching our own streaming service, because why not? Yeah. Well, one quarter later, Netflix pretty much hit their target. The company added 6.8 million subscribers worldwide, the most ever in the third quarter, though the U.S. only added 520,000 of those subscribers. Its stock immediately rose 10%. As for the competition, Netflix said, well, heck, We've been facing linear TV and cable and premium cable and YouTube and all those other services from the start. And we do have 158 million subscribers worldwide. Sing about that, Ms. D. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. They're back on track. No, they're not. They're just doing what they were always doing. There's some fascinating things came out of this, though. They're tired of breaking down subscribers by territory. Yeah, it's too misleading, they say. It just distracts you when we tell you how many people we added in North America.
Yeah, you know why they don't want to do this? Because they've realized, as they become more mature, that territories mature, okay? And then they plateau. Because everybody has a Netflix subscription at that point.
Yeah, there's 60 million people in the U.S. with a Netflix subscription. They're at saturation level. They're not going to add 2 million people in North America. It's not going to happen.
Right. So then they're going to have churn. And this is the same thing that happened with the iPhone and Apple. They're like, well, we're not going to tell you how many iPhones we sold anymore.
In this territory. We'll just tell you worldwide.
Yeah, well, I don't even think they do that anymore.
But Netflix is going to continue to tell you worldwide how many they've added, just not break it down by territory. So if they were always saying, right, if they never broke it down by territory, and they said, okay, we added 6.8 million subscribers this quarter, you'd say, well, that sounds like a lot, right? And Stranger Things 3, they say that set a viewing record. That's what they say. They say at least 60 million households watched at least most of one episode. You know, if you watch 70% of an episode or a movie, they count that series, season, or that movie as being watched. And they also detailed other hit shows like Unbelievable and La Casa de Papel, aka Money Heist, which is their biggest hit not in English. But no word on the final season numbers for Orange is the New Black, which means interest had probably pretty much dimmed by then. So they continue to list top shows. They continue to share information on viewership when they want to. And you know what? Maybe HBO should do the same thing. Watchmen broke on HBO. We've had two episodes now. The overnights were 1.5 million people.
Ooh,
why mention them at all? You know, wait a week. You're going to have a lot more people catching up on Watchmen in a week or two. But we'll be getting to that in Inside Baseball.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Is this a good time to mention that HBO has now like three versions of its service? HBO Go, HBO Max.
I thought Now and Go was just one was just, you know.
HBO Go is if you're a cable subscriber.
Right. It's just a way to watch it on other platforms. It's not like a new service.
HBO Now is if you're not a cable subscriber.
HBO Go is not something you pay for. It's just something you get as an HBO subscriber. It's just so you can watch. Yeah. So it's not like it's a different service. It's just to allow you to use other platforms to watch it. It's just a technical thing. It's not like something you pay for.
But they're branding three different things. So.
All right. Well, they all say HBO.
Good point. Now, Netflix has competition. We talked about that. And that competition is getting fierce. And we're going to talk about that as well. Now, hold on, says Netflix. We've always had competition like NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, YouTube, and yeah. Okay, look, we already talked about that. But whatever. Disney Plus and Apple are breathing down their necks. First, Disney made waves. It announced anyone with a Verizon account and an unlimited data plan would get an entire year subscription to Disney Plus for free. Wait a second. I have Verizon, but I don't have unlimited. Do I want to get unlimited? How much more would that actually be?
A lot more.
They're also giving out the first 3 months free to many others that qualify. Analysts were impressed and upgraded estimates of how many subscribers Disney Plus would snag early on. Of course, Apple already promised a year of free Apple TV to anyone that made new purchases of major Apple hardware. Do my AirPods in Midnight Green count?
They'll be AirPod Pro.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Maybe they do count. I don't know. Who knows? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I thought this was bizarre. Disney said, we're going to give away subscriptions for free. And analysts said, genius, they will add more subscribers. It's like, yes, if they give it to you for free, they will be able to get. But will they convert a year from now? That's when you'll know whether it was a success. But like, we're giving it away for free. You're geniuses. Your stock is going up. Netflix says we've got 160 million people worldwide. Ah, boo, boo. It's just analysts sometimes are just so reactive to like that afternoon's headline. And the idea that they're giving it away for free and that's some sort of genius promotional plan is bizarre to me. You have nothing to say about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just like Amazon. They're trying to, I mean, this is very standard for launching a subscription
service. Yeah, you want people to look at it and try to get them on get their credit card info and they'll forget to cancel it a year from now.
Ideally you want people using your service rather than not using it. But yeah, that does happen. And they, you know, breakage, basically.
Yep.
Hey, if Disney Plus and Apple TV are competitors for Netflix, so is the theater chain AMC. And I don't mean, by the way, just people going to see movies at their multiplexes. AMC just announced it is getting into the renting and selling of movies. Okay, that's what they're going to do. Via VOD, they are about to make streams and downloads of movies available via their website. Hey, you already head to AMC.com for new movies. Why not head there when you want to rent or buy a digital download? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop if it's 2009.
Yeah, you mean a big deal if it's 2009.
A big deal. Yes.
Yeah, I was like, you know, welcome to, you know, last decade.
2012.
Yeah, I'm like, good grief.
But there was a little bit of news that you should probably be a lot better to talk about. Landmark Theater Chain is the biggest independent chain in the country, the most successful, and the guy who's been leading it, Ted Mundorf, new owners took it over, and now he's been told to take a hike. They just did not agree on philosophy and how to do business, and so now he's left. And that was a bit of an earthquake for the indie distribution world and exhibitors. What do you say?
I say it'll be very interesting to see where Landmark Theaters goes. It's without a doubt the largest art house chain in the U.S., and they did really, really well with what
And do you think if you liked Landmark and Ted was the head, what exactly is he doing that you don't like today?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. None of the stories that I read on this went into it in any detail.
Right. So it's like, well, his philosophy didn't change over the last 10 years up to now. Yeah. And they've done all this innovation and they seem to be making money. So what exactly are you fighting over? So
well, and
maybe
I can
who's
tell you,
in charge?
You know, AMC has let a number of people go. They let like 75 people go recently. I know that the news said 35, but it was more like 70, 75. And they let a ton of people go in Europe from Odeon. Which so something, you know, they're trying to right size their business and really trying to when you start doing that, it's never a good thing.
Because they're not cutting fat. You feel like they're cutting valuable people.
I think when you're cutting people that have been there for 24 years, yes, you're, you know, certainly in the EU, they're cutting valuable people.
Mm. Is there been a downturn, or you think they're just preparing for a downturn, or wonder what's going on?
I think everybody's wondering what's going on. I think they are preparing for a downturn if there hasn't been one already.
All right.
Well, I mean, the guy who built the AMC Stubs program, which now has, you know,
seven figures of subscribers and is doing great.
Yeah, let go.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah.
Thank you for succeeding so well. Goodbye.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck with your new job as an Uber driver.
Yeah, it's pretty...
Well, that sounds pretty insider baseball-y, isn't it? And I guess it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And today we're going to talk about television. And it really feels like the revenge of the DVR and the revenge of streaming on demand. I mean, the TV season has begun and the news is not good.
You know, I've got to be honest with you. I kind of forgot the TV season started.
Well, it never ends. So let's put it in a different perspective. There's always good new content popping up. So yeah, you don't have the freedom to say, okay, it's the fall. I got 20 or 30 new shows to pay attention to. Five look promising. And now I'm done. I used to watch every new show that debuted. Every single new pilot I would watch. Well, those days have been over for decades. That's how old I am. But, you know, it's a whole new world. So the fact that you don't know the
fall... You're not going to start singing, are you?
It's a whole new world. So it's not bad that you didn't know the fall season was begun, because you were aware of the new shows. You were aware that Watchmen debuted.
Right,
you were aware. You know, you were aware of Stumptown, maybe, with Colby Smulders, who I like. I think she's really sexy and appealing and talented and really a good actress. And she's.
I have seen advertisements for it, but I thought it was for a coffee.
Stumptown, now available in decaf. So what's the big headline? What's going on here?
Well, viewing is down. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. And none of the news is good because the overnights are down. Live Plus 3 is down. Live Plus everything is down. And the demos are also down. I think it's It's because I know if I miss it, I can go catch it later.
Well, exactly. And the UK is facing problems too. There was a big article about the BBC, the first time ever, they have lost a grip on young people. Its share of the 16 to 24-year-old demos, which apparently is a big demo in the UK, we would say 18 to 34 in North America, but 16 to 24-year-olds, it dropped below 50% for the first time in history. And put that in the context of the BBC doing a pretty darn good job of launching their iPlayer and online stuff where they're capturing audiences, and they just had a big hit with Bodyguard. So they're always sort of skewing a little bit older, but they have been doing a good job of staying on top of technology. And yet, for the first time ever, most young people are not watching the BBC.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me, and I call this the New Yorker problem, mm-hmm. okay? And you're going to get this one, I think.
The magazine or the city?
The magazine, and I think you'll understand. Have you ever been a subscriber to the New Yorker?
Of course.
And you know, one of the things, and every New
not
Yorker...
Not me. I read them all. But yes, they pile up. You're like, I want to read them someday. But that was right. Because back in the day, the New Yorker was an evergreen. Then a 400-page article on the eraser. And you thought, you know what, someday I'm going to read that. But you didn't feel like, oh, it's the latest breakdown of Watchmen. I have to read it now. It was not stuff that had to be read immediately, which is what Tina Brown sort of changed at the New Yorker for ill, not good. But that sense of being timeless and being something that you could just dip into whenever you wanted, that was sort of the strength of the New Yorker. But yeah, issues would pile up. You knew it was good quality, but you knew you'd get to it someday.
Right. And you never did, by the way.
Well, I did, but yeah.
Well, yeah. Delayed viewing is also down. I think that's because people are recording it and then going, I will totally watch that, and then never do.
Right. So you obviously shows are adding viewers on delayed viewing, but even when you do that, they're not drawing as big as audience as they were one season earlier. But somebody is doing pretty good, and that's football. Football is America's game.
I know. Remember when we were just talking about it last year, about how it was kind of hurting.
The football Sunday night just beat Game 5 of the World Series. A regular season football game beat Game 5 of the World Series. It's been a really well-played, exciting World Series, too, frankly, I think.
It depends on which team you're rooting for, because I can tell you that the Washington Nationals, I think I got a phone call yesterday to see if I could pitch or hit for them because, you know, they scored 3 runs in 3 games.
Well, so. I've been rooting for the Washington Nationals. I don't want Houston Astros to win, but nonetheless, it's still been a fun game to watch. A heartbreaker.
The best was, I guess, in game 3 or 4, I can't remember which one it was, they gave an award as top reliever of the year. Do you know who they gave it to?
Was it Aroldis Chapman?
Yes, they gave it to Aroldis Chapman, who actually had that home run hit off of him, which meant that the Yankees weren't going to the World Series. I mean, it's like he lost the series for the Yankees.
It's and, a team effort.
Top reliever.
It's a team effort.
Yeah, it's just...
he got them to that point by pitching well all season long. Well, you know, so much for America rejecting football. The ratings are up a little bit this season. The kneeling controversy has died down. People aren't talking about the long-term injuries that players face. There's legalized gambling on sports in more states. And there's a lot of fantasy football leagues, which has really helped football. There's people, when they can gamble on it, they're going to watch it because they're not just betting on who wins the game. They're betting on third quarter, you know, sort of little weird little side bets and fantasy football. I know a lot of people who do fantasy football, which means, again, you're going to pay a lot more attention to the game. So that stuff is helping prop up football despite all the issues it has. And TV overall does have a bright spot. It is live plus 30.
What?
You do see significant jumps on live.
Are they counting like Hulu viewing or
live
something?
Live plus 30 and even beyond when looking at past seasons. So there is still looking like there is a really strong thing for television. You might say, I'm going to watch The Good Place, but you're going to wait till the whole damn series is over. And that doesn't help the networks. That doesn't help advertisers, but it's available to you, and you know it's available to you. And like you said, people's habits have changed. Do I feel the need to watch The Good Place season 4 while it's going on the air? No. Let me know when it's all done, and I'll jump in then. And that's...
I love Mr. Robot, okay?
Uh-huh.
Love that show.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. It started up again. I had no idea.
Well, don't you have it taped to automatically record?
You know what? I do, and I wonder if it's actually doing that.
Okay.
I should go check, actually.
It might be on your DVR right now. So, yeah, no, but yeah, when you have a show you love, you typically will say tape the series, and there you won't miss it when it comes back on the air because who can keep track of the schedule? But yes, with DVR and streaming, and 365 programming of TV shows, and not knowing that Mr. Robot is known for coming back in, you know, October, or is it February, or is it June? You know, there's all these shows, 6 episodes, 10 episodes. You're not watching the new season because you're busy binging on Insecure or Better Call Saul or catching up with Billions. This is the new way people consume TV. It's great for the viewers. It is not great for the networks or the advertisers. And that's why one of the big news is of today, the largest owner of TV stations in the United States is dropping traditional ratings. Nexstar owns about 200 stations in mid-level and small markets.
So they basically, you know, will be affiliates of like NBC or CBS.
ABC and Fox, absolutely. Yeah. And they are dumping the traditional advertising numbers. They want to emphasize all the eyeballs they capture on every platform. In fact, the TV station trade organization wants Madison Avenue to start using viewer impressions as the main metric for ad sales. Nexstar is actually working with Comscore. We pulled information from Comscore to do our worldwide box office, and they're working with them to develop a metric and data that they can use to sell to advertisers, because they're saying the current numbers, live plus three, and, you know, that's not doing it for us. We're missing out on too many people. Even live plus three, people are watching on their phone, online, this way, that way, and the other way. And we need to start tabulating them, because otherwise we're going to be out of business. So
I think we're going to go back to, a show being brought to you by Winston Cigarettes.
Well, absolutely. In show advertising, I mean, you know, you watch network shows now, they've got their logo in the bottom right corner, and often in the lower left hand corner they have some advertising for the next show or something else or season premiere, and it flashes in and out. Yeah, you know, you're just gonna have a permanent ad on the TV, because otherwise people aren't going to see your ads, because like you say, we said at the top, viewing patterns have changed permanently. Your show might take a year to find its audience. You know,
I'm just glad that the shows don't stack up on my bookshelf like my New Yorker magazines.
Right, because, New Yorker, and you know, once at some point you throw them out. You're like, this magazine is dead to me.
Wait, dead? Did you say dead? Because we do have some people that passed away, have died, that we need to talk about, like K-pop star Sully.
Or Sully. I'm not sure. I should have looked up her name. I apologize. I've never even heard of her, but she died at 25. And once I started reading about her in Billboard, there was an appreciation for her by Jeff Benjamin that really woke me up to this star and how interesting she was. She was an outspoken female star of K-pop, when K-pop prefers all its stars, women and men, but especially women, to be demure, maybe sexy, but no opinions, please. She was known for her beauty and moving into acting. She began in a girl group called FX. And of course, when you're in a girl band, you're not supposed to date at all.
But no, because you're supposed to be available to all of the male. Yeah.
Right. And so you're modeling movies. She had a controversial attitude, like saying she's not a fan of bras or daring to take photos of herself with her boyfriend. She was pro-choice. I'll bet she read that book we were talking about at the top of the show, Kim Ji-young, born 1982. And so she really raised visibility of mental health issues and cyberbullying, and talked about a lot of issues and things relative to other K-pop stars that really made her an outlier and an admirable figure. And unfortunately, she died by suicide. She had a lot of
mental health issues.
She took a lot of crap online, you know, and this is a big problem in social media, especially when you're in these intensely social media centric groups. You know, you got a new haircut. Oh my God, it looks horrible. You know, so, I mean, you know, a lot of abuse and a lot of stuff she had to deal with. And she probably had her own mental health issues, but it certainly didn't help being in the spotlight that she helped raise issues for that. And hopefully, if there's any silver lining, that she'll continue to do that, unfortunately, just from the example of what happened to her. So it's not clear that she exhibited any warning signs. Police say no note was found. So there aren't any of the classic, at least from the outside so far, any of the classic things that you would look for and say, hey, let's make sure this person gets help.
But I think it was murder.
Well, very sad ending to a smart, interesting person who spoke her mind.
Well, also dying was Bob Kingsley at the age of 80. He was a radio DJ in the country format.
That's right. He was the Casey Kasem of country. He hosted a hit song countdown show. He's done it for the past 40 years, most of it in one show, and then he moved over to another like a decade ago. And it's kind of a fun little detail. As a child, he spent a year in bed fighting polio. And while he was doing that, he listened to the radio to entertain himself. And that sort of led him into being a DJ. And I started thinking about all the people who sort of had childhood illnesses like Scorsese and his asthma that kept him from sports and got him headed to the movies. Like all these people had these illnesses. All right, I ended up in bed reading, or I ended up in bed sketching, or I ended up going to the movies because of these things that were burdens to them as a kid, but it sent them off into the direction that made their life.
Now, I guess one, the New York Times missed an obituary.
Well, yeah, they have a section called Overlooked where they highlight people who died in the past that they'd never honored at the time of their death. And now they're going back and saying, yeah, you know what? We ignored these because they're women or people of color, or we didn't appreciate their importance at the time. So they got this whole ongoing series where they write a full obituary for people who deserved it at the time.
Okay, and Lottie Reininger is an animator who was one of these people. I did see that, actually.
Yes, it was very cool. She wrote and directed the oldest surviving animated film, 1926, is The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. It's charming and often shown on Turner Classic Movies. We talked about it very recently because of Abominable and how that movie was written and directed by a woman and how rare that was for any Hollywood movie, but especially an animated film. So it was cool to see just when we talked about her and that movie, Prince Ahmed, that suddenly it popped up in the New York Times. She did 60 works in all using the silhouette animation and the technique of cutting out shapes and designs in paper with scissors is called Scherenschnitte, something like that. It originated in China and became really popular in Germany. She studied it and practiced it and then used it to create the animation stuff that she did. Prince Ahmed involved creating 250,000 frames, of which 100,000 of them were used in the final film. Of course, it's 24 frames per second, and the film ran about 81 minutes. She pioneered an early version of a multi-plane camera to give animation more depth. The movie took 3 years to make. It was financed by a banker, and she was 27 years old when it debuted. And Jean Renoir saw the film on its opening night in Paris and loved it.
And then immediately tweeted about it, how much he liked it.
Right. I don't know if he had a Twitter account, but our final person we're going to talk about this week is certainly a legend in Hollywood.
Oh my gosh. And actually, I can tell you, Robert Evans is actually one of my Facebook friends.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah, I just realized that. And of course, Robert Evans is a producer, former studio executive. He was really young. Actually,
he was 36 when he took over Paramount.
Right. Yeah. And he was there for a decade, or roughly a decade. And he turned it around. Paramount was kind of like,
they were number nine. They were the ninth ranked studio, and he made them number one. How did he do it? What were the movies? What were the hits that he made happen?
Well, forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. And a little movie called The Godfather.
And
I know
Rosemary's,
you hate it when I do
and
that.
I do hate it. And Rosemary's Baby. Was Chinatown a big commercial hit?
That's a good question. It certainly was a huge critical hit.
Oh, absolutely. And even while he was a studio head, he was also allowed to keep producing films, which was really unusual. So even while he's at the head and greenlighting these movies, he also did The Odd Couple, True Grit, Love Story, Harold and Maude, which was not a hit on its first initial release. But boy, he also pushed Paramount to buy Desilu, the Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz company, and Simon & Schuster. So he was a legend. He had a crazy life. I mean, he became rich in fashion by partnering with his brother on Evan Pacone, which was a fashion line that made pants fashionable for women to wear and was bought out for a massive $10 million. Back then, that was a lot of money. And so he was doing business in Hollywood, and Norma Shearer spot him and put him in a film. Then Zanuck saw him dancing in a New York nightclub and cast him in as a bullfighter in The Sun Also Rises. He was literally a businessman on one coast and a movie star on another. Edward R. Murrow interviewed him and said he was had the most interesting life of anyone he'd known since the war. it's just a crazy guy. He pushed Coppola to add a half hour to The Godfather to restore its warmth and humanity, and he won that battle. And later they broke forever on The Cotton Club, which has just been restored and re-released. And he has an infamous memoir that became a must-hear on the audiobook.
That's right. It was one of the first must-hear books.
Right, because he did such a great job narrating it. Kim Masters had a point to make. I mean, Robert Evans died at 89. The second half of his career was a disaster. Drugs, abuse, crappy movies. Even when he was sort of successful, there was junk compared to the great, great films he made in the first half of his life. And in fact, when asked what he'd like to change about his life, he said the second half. That was at some festival or something in recent years. But Kim Masters pointed out, you know what, before you glorify this guy and talk about him, this is a guy that probably Harvey Weinstein modeled himself after. you know, let's just keep, I'm saying that, not Kim Masters, but she said there's a very dark side to Robert Evans. He was old school Hollywood, yes. Not just in the fact of personal drug abuse and whatever, but in the way he did business and how he did it and who he did it with and how he treated people. So let's not make him out to be a saint. I mean, he never pretended to be, but he thought he was charmingly devilish. But in fact, probably from a bygone era, and the better for that.
And, you know, have you listened to that audiobook?
I haven't. I've always wanted to.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, it's him narrating it, and he's always like, you know, do you think I did such and such? You bet I did, baby.
Like, it's just crazy, over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? I met him a couple of times. The first time, he was a very vain person. The first time I met him was in an elevator at Creative Artists Agency, and he got on the elevator, and the elevator doors closed, and the inside of the elevator, you know, was a shiny, like, mirror surface. And he was going to the third floor where all the big executives were. And I'm sitting there, and I was going to the third floor. He gets on, and we are riding up, and he's, you know, basically fixing his hair in the mirror and making sure his sunglasses are on straight. And, you know, the elevator door opens and he walks out. And I just thought, you know, how funny.
That's Robert Evans for you.
Yeah, exactly.
What was, like, the second time you met him? Or do you know? Does it not matter?
Yeah, it was, you know, at a premiere. A movie premiere, and then the third time was at a meeting that, you know, he came to pitch something. This was like 20 years ago, so he was, you know, even then he was like in his 60s.
Wow, there you go. Well, you know, that's it. That's our podcast. We're glad you're back. Will there be a show next week? Will you survive the fire?
I certainly hope so, although I'm scheduled to possibly go out of town, but, you know, not
you
yet.
Bastard. So. You
You know what? I'm a busy guy. What can I say? I'm in demand. But you know what? Just so that you don't miss the next show, please subscribe to us in iTunes, Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, and I believe Spotify, but I have to double check. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us. Ways to follow us. We're on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That is where our page can be liked. And of course, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where all of that information can be found. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It's whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week is something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Farmageddon. I just love it. It's a good title. Probably taken.
It probably is, but if you're looking to find some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work can be found. My work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.